Good evening. My name's Chip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. And I ain't had a drink all day long. Didn't hurt nobody today. Didn't hurt myself. Went to work for the first part of the day and paid my way. Might not mean much to you, but it sure does tickle my mama, I'll tell you. You know, how many of you guys and ladies this morning in your prayer and meditation when you first got up, how many of you asked what you could do to make Kip Collins' life just a little bit easier today? 1, 2, 3. Thank you. You helped. The rest of you, it's just like everywhere I go. You're all selfish and self-centered and self-seeking. So tomorrow I want you to get up and think about me before you think about you. You know, and I only say this because I love you. You know, and I need all the help I can get. My life hasn't been easy, drunk or sober. I want to thank you for asking me to come up here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you at your conference. I've heard of this conference for a long time. The guy that 12 stomped me into this program was an active member of the Hospital Institutional Committee, a man named Charles Tuck, and he's passed on now, and I'll break his anonymity. But my father's Irish and Sioux. My mother's Irish and Cherokee. And when my dad drank, my mom liked to fight, you know, and it was nuts around our house. You know, we lived in an all-Mexican neighborhood, and my cousins had very dark skin and dark hair and brown eyes. And all the kids in the neighborhood, they were all Mexican. Nobody spoke any English. And I had white hair and blue eyes and very white skin. And something was amiss. You know, I walked out of that house, me and my brother Bill, we'd go outside and those Mexicans wanted to beat our ass. And we walk back in the house and the Indian would want to beat our ass, you know. And we'd stand in that doorway for a long time wondering which way we were going to go, you know. And the result of that, I learned about fear, you know. I learned fear was completely ran my life. And the way I reacted to that fear was through violence. And I found out at an early age that if I would do anything in the world to prove to you I wasn't afraid of you, that you'd leave me alone, you know. And that's the way me and my brother operated. You know, I don't blame my alcoholism on my father. My father gave me a prime example of what alcohol will do to a man, what it will do to a family, to a marriage, to children. I mean, he was a perfect example of what not to do. You know, I blame it on the San Diego Unified School District myself. They had this great idea in the early 60s that it was time to start educating the young people about the dangers of that other stuff that we don't talk about in AA. And so, you know, I went to this auditorium like this, and they had these people come up and talk, and they showed this movie. I'll tell you, when it was over with, my mouth was drooling, you know. I wanted some of this, whatever it was. If it made you do feel that way, I said, you know, and it ain't liquor, so it couldn't hurt me. And I asked my friend Balto, I said, can you get some of this stuff? And he says, yeah. The next day, we got together, and we went down this canyon. And I said, well, what do we do? He said, well, we got to steal some wine. And I said, what for? And he says, I don't know. My dad drinks wine with this stuff. And we got it the way he did, so he sure gets screwed up on it, you know. So we went in, and we made our first attempt at supporting Modesto, you know. We stole some Gallo wine and sweet red port. And I went down this canyon and drank that wine and smoked that stuff. And it was the most magic moment of my life. Something happened there. You know, I heard a guy named Serenity Sam. I don't hear him very much anymore. But he was one of the first people I ever heard speak, and I was brand new, and he walked up and he started talking about the way he felt. And he said, I fell out of my mother's womb and I hit a cold concrete floor. And I was crawling across hostile territory towards my grave. And then I discovered alcohol, you know, and everything is wonderful ever since. And I knew exactly what he was talking about because, you know, I was absolutely, totally full of fear. I was terrified of this world, and when I drank that stuff, something happened inside of me, and I knew that this was a solution. And it was a solution. It changed my reality. It made my skin fit. It made me not afraid. It took away all that fear, and it allowed me to live my life. You know, a couple years later, I got kicked out of school in the seventh grade for hitting a teacher. And I got home, and my mom had found my stash, and she said, "Get out." And I didn't argue with her. She liked to fight. She was a lot meaner than my dad. And she would hit you with a shovel or something. And I left, you know, this was 1964. I'd never been anywhere. President Kennedy, I think, had just been killed. And I'd never done anything. I lived in a little farm in town. Nothing ever happened there. And I was over in a place called Carlsbad and wondering what I was going to do. And this guy was going, "Hey, check this out." And I went, "What?" He says, "Look, in the paper," he says, "they got this deal going on in San Francisco. And all these people do is they get high and listen to music and make love." I like music. You know? So I got my little 14-year-old butt out on the freeway and I hitchhiked up to San Francisco and I got up in the Haight-Ashbury district and they were right. There was a lot of music and a lot of everything else. And it was fun and I had the greatest time a human being can possibly have. You cannot do things like that anymore. You know, the world has just changed. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. And I lived there for the next 3 years. And while I was living in there, you know, other men, young men, you know, were going to school. They were learning trades. They were doing the things that young men do, and I learned something different. I knew a different, found a different way to live. I found out at a very early age that if I had this product that people wanted, you know, that I didn't have to do everything they told me I had to do. You know, I could have anybody or anything I wanted, and I could do and go where I wanted. And, you know, and I had people's respect, and better than that, I had their money. You know, and as a result of that, I got arrested in Mexico when I was 16 years old. I got caught with 200 kilos of marijuana. And they sentenced me to 25 years in La Mesa Federal Prison. I don't know if there's anyone here that's been in prison in Mexico. But it's not a real comfortable place for a young Caucasian male with blonde hair and blue eyes. Nice things don't happen in there. If anything in the world, that should have taught me the way I'm living. I ought to get out of here, man. I ought to change my life, man. I ought to go to school. I ought to get a job. I ought to start following directions. But you know, I've always got something going, and I had a little bit of protection there. I saw a lot of horrible things, but I got out of there. You know, I love Mexico. It's a civilized country. You can bribe people, you know. You find the right person, and you can get away with anything, you know. And I finally got out after about 9 months. And I got back across, and I continued to do what I was doing, you know. And by the time I was 18, I got arrested on my 18th birthday at 5:30 in the morning and charged with 27 felonies. And I went back. I went to prison. I was in county jail for almost a year and a half fighting this thief before I was even sentenced. And you know, when I went in, I'd been living with this young gal, and she was pregnant. And I was real excited about this. I really cared for this woman as much as I knew how to care for anybody. But I was really excited about this baby. And when I finally got out, I went and go looking for her. And nobody would tell me where she was. Her family wanted nothing to do with me. And I looked for her everywhere. And for the next many, many, many years, there was this big hole in my gut looking for that child that I wanted to find out. I didn't know if it was a boy or a girl. I didn't know anything. I just know that I had a child somewhere. I met this gal after I got out, and she bailed me out of jail 3 times in 1 week, and that's pretty close to love, you know? That's pretty close. I'd much rather have someone that I can count on in those situations. And I never let you out of my life. And she was 15 years old, and we got married. And her family was rich, and I thought I was going to get some of it. Instead, they just cut us completely off. Smart people. You know, and me and that little girl went for a ride, you know. And for the next couple of years, we raised hell all over the place. We had a lot of money, and we had a good time. And I got busted again. And I'm probably the only guy has ever got off a second offense of sales of heroin because I had a bad lawyer. But I had an alcoholic lawyer, God bless him, and he would show up to court every single day drunk, and he looked like he was living in his car, and he probably was, and he needed a shave, and he never said one thing through my whole trial. And they sentenced these other two guys. And he got to me, and he sentenced me to 10 years, and he looked at me, and he looked at my lawyer, and he said, suspended. And he says, and I want to see you in my chambers for the lawyer. You know, and I'm probably the only guy that's ever got off that I had a bad lawyer. But and we got out of there, you know. We got out of there. We moved up to Oregon, and one day, it was a magic day, a magic, magic day. We went to the hospital, and she gave birth to a little boy. And she came out and she put that little baby in my arms, and it was the greatest thing besides alcohol that ever happened to me in my life. And I looked at that little boy, and for the very first time in my life, I fell absolutely, totally, completely in love with another human being. And I promised him I would never do the things that my father did. I promised him the things that I was going to do and the kind of life we were going to have, and I was going to protect him. And we were going to do all these things, and I meant it with all my heart. But I continued to do what I do, and a couple of years later, she, the same thing happened, and she put a little girl in my arms, Jana Marie, and I fell head over heels in love with this little girl, just absolutely, passionately in love with this little girl, and I promised her the same thing. You know, at that period of my life, drugs and alcohol were not a problem. The lifestyle I lived was a little dangerous, and there was a lot of consequences that went with it. And I made a lot of money, and I had a lot of stuff, and I didn't work too much. You know, I was out of town a lot, but when I was home, I was with my kids, and we had a real nice place, and I spent all my time with my kids. My whole life revolved around them. In 1976, on January 6th, I was outside, and I was playing with my son. My son, when he was born deaf. And it was a hot day, and we were messing around, you know, and I got real thirsty. I got real thirsty. And I just got on my bike. I didn't tell anybody nothing. I just got on my bike and scooted up to the store to go get a six-pack of beer. And while I was there, my life changed because I came back down that hill. The police were there and the paramedics and the fire department and all the whole neighborhood was there, and I didn't know what was going on, and I waded through that crowd, and I found out that my son had chased me out of the driveway. He had been run over by a truck, and I waded through that crowd of people, and I saw my son laying there with his skull broken up and his brains, and most of the bones in his body were broken. And the thing that I loved more than anything in this world, you know, absolutely just cherished this child. You know, and I'd taken the responsibility to take care of him, And I got loaded, and I spaced my responsibilities, and he paid for it. My son spent the next 9 months in a coma, and I was at that hospital, and I was crying out to this God I'd never asked anything or knew anything about to give me back my son. And they told me every day to pray that he died because there was so much brain damage that he'd be a vegetable the rest of his life. And my son survived. He survived that accident, but he went through over 27 major surgeries in his life, and he never emotionally or mentally evolved beyond the age of about 4 years old. And every time I saw my son, I saw what I had done. This guilt, this tremendous feeling of guilt, you know, and all I can tell you is thank God for alcohol. Because alcohol took away those feelings, you know. But after that, my brother would, anything I told you about, you know, my brother was with me. We were 11 months apart, and he was my right hand. And we backed each other's play, any place. He's the one that got me out of that jail in Mexico. And he was my partner. All my life, we were partners. He was my dearest and best friend. The only man in the world I trusted completely, you know. And my brother got real sick, and they told me he had a disease called schizophrenia. And my family had him put in the hospital, and he called me after they got him stabilized in this hospital. He said, get me out of here. You know, and I had the money, and I got a lawyer, I got conservatorship, I bought him a trailer, I put it on some property next to mine, and I brought him home. You know, and me and my brother continued to do what we did. And my brother started getting sick again. He started getting real sick because he got away from his doctors, his medication, and he started living the way we were living. And I had to go. I had a big scam going in the Midwest. And he was crying. He said, don't leave me here, man. Don't leave me. Something's wrong. I'm coming apart. And I had to go. And I had to pull his hands off of me. And I said, here's some money, man. I said, as soon as I get back, we'll fix this. And I was gone for 3 weeks instead of 3 days. And when I got back to go find my brother, I went. Nobody had seen him. And I went to that trailer, and I opened the door, and my brother's head rolled out. And he had taken a gun on the third day and blown his head off, and he had been dead for 3 weeks, and it was just a big pile of maggots laid in that doorway. And another big piece of me died that day. You know, I don't tell you this part because I need anybody's sympathy. You know, the only point of this whole story, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it tells us that there are people among us who got here with grave emotional and mental disorders, you know, and I'm one of those people. Something inside of me broke that day, absolutely in half. It was never, ever to be restored until I completely surrendered to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you this, from my heart to yours, that I thank God that alcohol worked. If alcohol would not have done for me what alcohol does for me, I would have joined my brother in a minute, you know. The pain, the guilt, the feelings were so intense. Those visions in my face of all that ugly, horrible stuff. I couldn't get it out of my face. I couldn't get it out of my mind. And I drank, and alcohol worked. And thank God for alcohol. You know, they talk a lot about bottoms in AA. I don't know. I've seen a lot of bottoms. I work in a home, a residential for men who have lost absolutely everything in the world. Most of about half of them just got out of prison, and they got nowhere to go and nothing going on in their life. And I watch a couple of them die every week. And I've seen a lot of different types of bottoms. But every time, I would think it couldn't get no worse. I found a basement, you know. You know, in that. Of course, my wife, she was a real smart gal. She made a career move at about this time. She left me for my coke dealer because I was not functioning very well anymore. And it was a good choice, you know. He had a lot more going on than I did. I applauded her. You know, and she left, and my son was in this hospital, and he was just practically a vegetable at that time, and he left me with my little girl. I mean, she was 7 years old, and I couldn't stop drinking, and it was just me and this little girl. This little girl was terrified. She had had this beautiful home and all this stuff, and her father around her, and her brother, and everything in her life was wonderful for her whole life. And then her brother was wiped out, her favorite uncle was killed, you know, her mother left, the whole house was falling apart, and her dad was absolutely insane, and she was scared to death, and I was all she had. And then this guy brought this stuff over called Mad Dog 2020. You guys have that up here? Yeah. It changed my life. Yeah, oh man, I'd never drank it before, you know, and I drank this bottle of Mad Dog with him, and the next thing I know, this lady's going, "Excuse me, sir, but you have to get off the plane." I was sitting in my living room, you know, in Vista, California, and I opened my eyes and I looked around and I'm all dressed up and my little girl snuggled up asleep next to me and I'm on this big airplane and it's completely empty except for me and her. And I said, "Where am I?" She said, "You're in Fort Lauderdale." I said, "I don't like Fort Lauderdale." And she goes, "I don't know anything about that. You got to get off the plane." And so I try to regroup, you know, and I don't want to look stupid in front of my daughter any more than I already am, you know. And so I get out, and she's going, "What's going on?" You know, and I'm trying to real casually ask her, "What the hell are we doing in Florida?" You know, but I didn't want to scare her, you know. But I was scared to death. I had no idea what had happened, and so I called a cab, and I said, "Listen, I need you to take me to a hotel, but stop on a liquor store on the way there, because I got to figure out what's happened here." And I woke up on this gurney, completely restrained, in this room, the gray brick room with bars on the windows. And I had no idea how I'd gotten there, and I had no idea where my daughter was. I didn't know anything. I woke up absolutely terrified and scared out of my mind. And I found out that I'd met some people at this hotel, and we decided to go to this bar, and I got real drunk and real crazy and flipped out. And they put me in a nut house. Nice guy like me. And I got out of the hospital, you know, and thank God those people had taken my daughter. They didn't know us from Adam, but he had taken my daughter. And I got out, and I told her, I said, "Come on, Janet, we got to get out of Florida. This place is bad luck." And I don't need to go into it, you know, but I'll tell you, for the next 2 years, that story was repeated over and over and over and over. I lived in 5 different states. A continuous state of fear, of running, of crying, "It's going to be different over here, it's going to be different over there," one step ahead of the law everywhere I went. Every place we lived, we ran from. By the time my daughter was 9 years old, we were living in Oklahoma. We were living in a little one-room flat, little hole in the wall with cockroaches, and I'd got this horrible little job I'd been working at for a little bit, and I could stay sober as long as I could, but I got drunk in this bar and I hurt this man real bad, and I come running in that house and I had blood on my clothes and it wasn't mine. And she just looked at me, and it was just that look of resignation, and she picked up her doll and her pillow and she grabbed that. I changed my clothes, and we ran out of that place, and we got to a bus, and I passed out on the bus. And I come to in Gallup, New Mexico, and my little girl was crying, and she was rocking back and forth when I woke up, and I said, "What's the matter?" And she says, "Daddy, you haven't fed me, and I'm starving." And I said, "Okay, honey, as soon as we stop, I'll get you something to eat." We pulled in this little place, you know, you rode many buses, but there's always a real nice part of town where they're at, and especially Gallup, New Mexico. And I get out, I go in this little liquor store, and I go up to that cooler, and I get her a sandwich, you know, and I walk over to that thing. I'm so sick, I'm shaking so bad, I'm scared to death, I'm going to go into DT's, and I get a bottle of wine, and I go up to go pay for it, and I only got enough money for one or the other, and I got to put her sandwich back, you know. I can't get on that bus without a drink. You know, and I've done a lot of things in my life that I don't share from the podium and very selective people, but I've never done anything in my life that haunted me more than that moment. That look on my little girl's face, I was the only person in the world that she had, and she was starving, and I loved her with all my life, you know? But I had to drink. We got back here, and I hadn't seen my mother in years, and I went over to my mother's house and dragged my little girl, and her hair was dirty and she was dirty and I was a mess, and she just looked at me and she grabbed my daughter and she told me to get out, you know, and God bless my mom. My mom, you heard of black belt Al-Anon? She's nuclear. I mean, she released you with love on a drop of a dime, man. I mean, boom, like that, get back. You know, you can do that, but you can't do it here. And thank God, you know, because the next 3 years of my life, we're in mental institutions, we're in jails, we're living on the side of the road in bushes or any place else that I could lay down and panhandle for wine. Because every time I stopped drinking, I cried it, tried to put it together. All that guilt, all those feelings, all that stuff would come to the surface and it would make me absolutely insane, and I couldn't sleep, I couldn't think, I couldn't act unless I had the alcohol in my body enough. And thank God it worked. You know, I was standing in front of a 7-Eleven, and I think it was on a Sunday morning, and I was real sick. You know, I hear people talk about fear in meetings. I don't know if y'all got any other winos here, but if you ever stood in front of a 7-Eleven at 5:30 in the morning and they don't open up that cooler till 6, and you're shaking like a dog trying to pass a peach pit, you know, a bottle of wine cost 87 cents and you got 65, ain't nobody giving up a dime. And you don't know if you're going to make it. You don't know if you're going to go into convulsions right in front of that store. And then they're going to take you to a hospital and detox you, and you're going to have to start all over again. You get a lot of money invested in that wine by then. You don't want no one stopping you on a roll, you know. And I remember that fear. I was terrified I wasn't going to get that alcohol. And this guy came up, and he pulled up, and he was wearing a suit, and he had short hair, you know, and he pulled in his four-door sedan, with his square little wife and his square little kids, and he got out, and he walked by me, and he looked at me, and he goes, "Chip." And I'm like, "Where is this guy?" You know, and it was a guy I'd known when I was a kid. I had no idea how he recognized me. But he just looked at me and he smiled. He said, "Here," and he gave me $2. You believe in Santa Claus when something like that happens, you know? But $2, that's enough for a whole quart of wine. And a whole quart of wine is going to keep me well. It's going to keep me in that bush till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know? And everything's going to be okay. And I'm walking back. I got my wine and I'm shuffling back. And I looked up in that glass and I saw that family sitting in that car looking at me. And I cursed them, but I knew they were judging me. I knew they were talking about me. And I shuffled off to my little bamboo patch. You know. And as I opened that, I said, "La puerta," the doorway, you know. I wonder what's going to happen. And I don't care. You'll shut this thing off for 8 minutes. You can do anything to me if you shut this screaming off inside my head. And I had the weirdest thought I've ever had in my life. I went, "Maybe I ought to go to A&A. Well, that's a horrible thing to be thinking about at that time, you know. But I see all these different institutions I've been to, all you H&I people, were coming in there and they were telling me, "You don't have to live this way anymore. You never have to feel this way again. Blah, blah, blah." And I tried to explain to them, "I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs. You know, you just do not understand, you know. Wine's just a cheap hustle, you know. I'm just tired. And as soon as I get my stuff together, I'm going to quit." But, you know, they told me that if I go to A&A, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous would understand my problem and they would welcome me with open arms. And I don't know how, but I know friends of mine were at that meeting. And I do remember a big part of it. I walked in that meeting, and I came in the back, and the meeting was already started, and these people looked all like you people. All nice and clean. You looked like, you know, people that lived up in the suburbs someplace, you know, that just went to church on Sundays and worked 40 hours a week and, you know, watched football and all that stuff. It didn't look like the kind of people I knew, you know. I wonder if they had a room for more severe cases. And I was waiting for someone to welcome me, and I sat down next to this little gal, and she scooted right down like a rocket, you know. And, you know, I've been living in these same clothes for almost 3 years. And my hair was down about here, and my beard was down to here. I weighed about 130 pounds, and a whole bunch of stuff lived with me, you know. And I'm just looking around. I'm uncomfortable. So these people are looking at me, you know, and they're kind of, everyone's kind of putting things over their nose. And then, to top it all off, they start to talk about God, you know. And I'm going, then they pass the basket. I said, they're going to start singing, you know. They're going to start singing any minute. I know it. I knew this wasn't for me. I knew this was a mistake. I'm getting out of here, you know. And this one old gal, she kept looking at me from the moment I walked in that room. She kept smiling at me and trying to get my eye, and I figured she was one of them wet-brained women alcoholics I'd heard about somewhere, you know. Something wasn't right. As sick as I was, I knew I had nothing this woman wanted, you know. And but she kept smiling at me, you know, and I'm getting ready to get out of there. I'm nervous. And just before I stood up, she jumped to her feet. And she looked right across all those people at me, and she introduced herself. She said, when I walked into this room 27 years ago, she goes, I came in. I came in the back. Meeting had already started, and I looked around at all you people. And I knew that when you turned around to look at me, you'd know what I was, and you'd turn your back on me. Because you people were all looking like just nice, normal people. She was out raised on the streets of Long Beach, and I did everything a woman ever had to do out there on those streets. She goes, I grew up in institutions and prison. I've been a prostitute since I was 14 years old. And I came in, and I was tired. And I thought this would help me, but I saw you people, and I knew that you were different. I knew how you'd react, and I turned around to leave. But a lady grabbed me and brought me into the meeting and got me a cup of coffee and welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous and told me, don't go nowhere, we need you. And she proceeded to talk about the next 27 years of her sobriety. She talked about her home group. She talked about her sponsors. She talked about the steps and the traditions. She talked about service in the Hospital Institutional Committee and a lot of other forms of service she had been involved in. She talked about her marriage. She talked about the death of her husband. She talked about the joys and the sorrows and the talks about living her life free of alcohol. And she walked over in front of all those people, and she put her arms around me, and she kissed me right on the mouth. That was the bravest woman I've ever known in my life. Boy, I'll tell you. And she said, honey, she said, don't you go anywhere. We need you desperately. I do not ever remember in my life shedding a tear for anything. I don't show that part of me. Especially in front of other people. I don't cry. I didn't cry with my son. I didn't cry in the prisons. I never cried anywhere. I never let anybody see that. I had so much armor on. But when that lady said that to me, something happened inside. And the sob started deep inside of me, and it worked its way out, and I started bawling my brains out in that room. And then I started coming to this A&A. And you folks lied to me right from the very beginning, every one of you. You told me that if I would quit drinking, my life would get better. I have no idea what alcohol does for you. When I stop, you know, alcohol is not my problem. It never has been my problem. It never will be my problem. My problem is a solution to my problems, you know? I am absolutely acute allergic to sobriety, you know? I cannot understand in God's name why anybody would ever want to feel that way. you know. I would start to sober up and everything would get real, you know. And all those feelings would start coming up and all that stuff and those pictures and this anger and this rage and all this stuff. And you people are saying, easy does it. One day at a time. Think. What? Told me to get a sponsor. I've been on parole half my life. I'm not about to volunteer to one of you lops to run my life. You know? Saw that second step restore me to sanity. I've been seeing a psychiatrist since I was 9 years old. I tried to kill a kid when I was 9 years old. And they said that I was nuts then. So if you've been insane all your life, what are they going to restore you to? You know? So I let that one go. I got to that God stuff. I didn't want nothing to do with this God stuff. You know, God had nothing coming from me, and I had nothing come from Him, and that was just fine. God didn't like people like me. He liked people like you folks who lived up in the suburbs, man. He don't like people like me. You know, I cried out to that God a few times. He never cut me no slack. He had nothing coming. You know, and I'd listen to you people talk about that stuff. I just want to puke. And then you get to that fourth step and that fifth step, and I said, what the hell is that about? And he said, well, if you've got to write down everything you've ever done and admit it to another human being. I fell out of my chair laughing. Hey, I learned when I was a little kid, you don't cop to nothing, even if they got pictures, you know. Deny it. Demand a jury trial. Make them prove it, you know. After your sentence is up, walk out. Say, I'm innocent. That was a mistake, you know. Don't ever give it up, you know. I ain't about to let you people know anything, any weak part of me. I'm not telling you people nothing. If I told you some of it, I'd have to kill you, you know? I went on with the rest of that stuff, you know? And, you know, it was just, my dad had told me when I was a little kid, you know, he said, you know, if you want things in this world, you got to work hard, you got to school, you got to do this, you got to obey this rule, you got to do this, you got to do that. And it sounded like the same crap he had been telling me. You know, if you do this, you got to do that, you got to do this. You know what? I've been in three of the worst jails in two different countries. And I always land on my feet, you know. You sober me up, I'll get something going. I'll get some kind of thing going for me. I'll figure out a way. I'll get on top of this and I'll get out. You know, and I figured I'd come to this A&A long enough, it'd rub off. And I start going to these speaker meetings, and I learned all this lingo. Easy does it, one day at a time. Yeah, baby, how you doing, honey? Yeah, let's go have coffee, let's do this, yeah, I'll do that. You know, but I don't want to do nothing else. I don't want to change anything that I'm doing. I don't want to change anything in here. I ain't telling you people nothing except, how you doing? Fine, everything's just wonderful. You know, I want to rip your coat, you know. You know, I spent 6 years going to meetings almost every single day. For 6 years. And I couldn't get sober. I couldn't get up more than 30 days together. And that only through a special type of herb, you know. We don't talk about in AA. And, you know, it just wasn't working, you know. I wanted what some of you people had, not all of you, but some of you. I wanted what you had. I couldn't figure out. If I could, it would have been a tangible thing. I would have knocked one of you in the head and taken it, you know. I know how to get stuff that way. But it just wasn't happening, you know. And I woke up Christmas morning in that damn rubber room, completely shackled like a pig. Cops had beat me so bad my face was stuck to that rubber mat, you know, and I'm trying to rip my face up, and I look up, and it's Christmas morning, and these cops are looking down the windows at me, and they're laughing, and you just knew Santa Claus wasn't coming that day. You know, you just knew. You just knew you were going to get a bag of coal. And they let me out. I'd seen me in there so many times, and it was Christmas, and I'd just gotten smart with a cop, and they knocked the hell out of me, you know, like they did on a regular basis. And they just told me, we'll see you later, and I walked out of there. And it was right then and there that I knew I couldn't come back AA. You know, I knew that I was that person they talk about in Chapter 5. I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And I'm tired of being an embarrassment in here, of raising my hand over and over and over. And I'm not going to do it no more. I'm going to go drink. I'm going to go do what I do. You know, and that's exactly what I did. And I went and started drinking on January 6th, 1984. I've been drinking continuous from that day to that. And that was the worst day that ever happened to me in that my whole life. Because that was the day that alcohol stopped working. I remember it crystal clear. It stopped. It didn't work. It didn't block those feelings. It didn't block that fear. It wouldn't knock me out. I couldn't get drunk. I couldn't get sober. And there wasn't enough liquor in this whole world to take away that emptiness and that horrible, horrible loneliness. You know, I believe that alcoholics, we are the only people in the world that really understand to the very depth of our soul what loneliness means. That loneliness, if it was a tangible thing, it would have absolutely eaten me alive. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, In a Vision for You, it says there'll come a time where you will not be able to imagine life with alcohol or without it. You'll know loneliness that few people can imagine. You'll come to the jumping off spot and you'll wish for the end. And I know what that means right here to the very, very center of my whole being. Because when I finally realized that alcohol wasn't going to do for me what it has done for me all my life, and I've already been here and it don't work, there's only one thing left to do. And I pulled out my piece and put it to my heart and pulled the trigger, and I blew my left lung and two ribs out and knocked me all the way across the room. And the only thought I had at that moment was, thank God this nightmare is over. Thank God this nightmare is over. Let me out of here. When I come to in this hospital, you guys thought I died, didn't you? You know, there was this guy I told you a little about, named Charlie Tuck. I hated that man with a passion. He'd been sober in AA so long that I heard that there was only one A in it when he got here. You know, and he was Al Capone's bodyguard when he was a kid. He was an old man, man, and he'd been sober since, I don't know how long, a long, long time at that time. And he had come up to me in a meeting, and he had this real deep, gravelly voice. And when that six-year period that I was coming in and out, you know, and he came up to me and got right dead in my face this meeting, looked me right in the eye and stared at me. And he says, "You think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid?" And I looked him right back in the eye, you know, I gave him the best jailhouse look I could give him. And I said, "I'm tough enough, old man, don't you ever doubt that." And he looked at me and he got this big smile and he said, "You ain't tough." He said, "You're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room." He said, "That might make you dangerous, but it don't make you tough." And he walked away laughing at me, you know. When I got sober and I did my inventory, and I discovered that my biggest secret, my biggest fear that I've carried all my life, that ran my life, and that fear was of you other men. And I was absolutely terrified of you. I'll knife fight, I'll gun fight, I'll do whatever we gotta do. But I would rather have you kill me than to see that fear. And inside, I was dying at all times. I was the most scared human being on the face of the earth. And it ruled my life. And that old man saw completely through me, you know. So every time I'd go to a meeting, I'd make sure he wasn't there. I'd look in, that son of a bitch, and I'd leave. But that morning, when I woke up in that hospital with tubes coming out of every hole in my body, and I'd been out for 3 days, you know, and a new holes that I had made myself, and I hear this voice. I mean, this Charlie had a distinct voice. And I open one eye, and I look out, and there's Charlie Tuck standing there with that big, ugly blue book, and two newcomers, on each one on each side, and their eyes are about this big. You know, and they're going, "I go, oh God, I've gone to hell, and AA's here too, you know. Charlie Tuck's in charge of it. I ain't giving it up, you know. I'm not going to pretend like I'm coming to or nothing. I'm laying there, you know. I'm holding my mud. And Charlie doesn't say one word to me. He puts his arms around this guy, and he said, "Fellas, you see this guy right here?" And they go, "Yeah." And he go, "This is what happens to an alcoholic who doesn't take the steps. Come on, let's go." I wanted to at least pray for me or something, you know. I might add that those two young men are still sober to this day. I was doing active 12-step work long before I got sober, you know. I got out of that place, you know, and I continued to drink. Alcohol didn't work. It just didn't work. Nothing worked. Women didn't work. Dope didn't work. Liquor didn't work. Nothing worked. I just woke up every morning and I wanted to die. Every single morning my first thought was, I'm still alive. Why do I have to keep doing this? And I'd drink and I'd drink and I'd do whatever I had to do to get through that day, and I'd come through the next morning the same thought, I'm still alive. I come through on May 12, 1984, and the first thought I had in my mind that morning was ABCs that's read at the end of chapter 5 at every meeting. And that is a weird thing to be thinking about. First thing in the morning, I know I need to get something in my body before the screaming starts, praying it'll work. But I'm thinking about the first three things, and then it says basically the first three steps. It says, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol. I know I'm an I've got paperwork from the state of California claiming me to be a chronic alcoholic, so I haven't got no problem with denial about me being an alcoholic, you know. But it said I'm powerless. And I started thinking, I just laid in that rack that morning, and it was something happened. It was like a vision. It was just that moment of clarity that hopefully we all get to get, you know. And I remembered, and I could see it like I was watching it that morning on that bus with my daughter. Of me getting on there, and that child that I would give my life for. And I finally understood what that power means. And what alcohol, the way alcohol affects me is when I put alcohol in my body, from that second on, it doesn't matter about who I love, what I love. It doesn't matter about my plans. It sure as hell don't matter about yours. You know, I'm going to do whatever I got to do to get another drink, and I will do it until someone stops me. And I cannot stop after I start. And I finally understood that. And then it got to that next thing that, you know, that no human power was ever going to fix me. I kept hoping one of you gals were. You know, some of you tried. And if any of you are here tonight, I'd like to apologize. You know, and then I got to that last thing. That scared me when I realized that no human power was going to fix me. When I really realized what that meant, that nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody in any of these churches, nobody in this whole world was ever going to fix me. And I started thinking about all the people that had reached out and tried. And there had been a whole trainload of them. People, all kinds of people from every walk of life, just good human beings that had tried to help me. Not just Alcoholics Anonymous, but there was no human power in this world. How hard I had tried. I wanted to be sober worse than anyone I ever knew, but I couldn't stop drinking. And it got to that thing, that God couldn't, would if he were sorry. And I started thinking about the people that I had watched that had what I wanted. And there were the people that had what I wanted in this program. Walked with dignity. They had a little sparkle in their eye. And I watched them walk through stuff. And they didn't drink. And they all talked about this power that did for them what they couldn't do for themselves. And I got down on my knees that morning, the most sincere moment of my life, and I said this prayer that ain't changed much to this day. I said, you know, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you are, and I don't think it makes any difference. But from this moment on, I will do whatever you put in front of me if I don't have to drink. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. You know? The longer I've been sober, the more I know what a state of grace was given me that day. Because I knew from that moment on that if I could keep that simple concept, I wouldn't have to drink that day. And I got over to that old man Charlie Tuck's house. And he like he'd been waiting for me, you know. And I walked in and he said, what can I do for you? And I said, Charlie, I don't want to drink no more. He says, are you done? I said, I pray to God I'm done. He says, that's the right answer. He says, what are you willing to do? I said, whatever you say, boss. He says, okay. He says, Kip, I've been watching you for a long time. People like you don't get sober. You don't even get sober in AA. Something inside of you is broken. I don't know what it is. That's between you and your God. But if you'll walk like I walk and do what I do, you won't have to drink. He took me outside, out in this park. It was on Mother's Day. And all these families were in this park. And I was just a poor sot. And he took me out there. He says, get on your knees. And all of a sudden, I go, in front of all these people? says, Chip, these people have been stepping over you for the last 3 years.
You know.
You're up on your knees. That's an improvement. And we got down on my knees. Well, we got down on our knees in that park, and he taught me how to pray. And he detoxed me at his house with honey and orange juice and a lot of love and a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he said, now, I am the director of the Hospital Institutional Committee, and everyone I sponsor is involved in the Hospital Institutional Committee, and you are coming with me tonight. Charlie was blind in one eye. You know those little dots on the freeway? Those were put there for Charlie Tuck. But he was blind in his right eye, and he had talked to you, he had to look at you. He would put that front tire on that bump and got going to one of these institutions we were going to. And he'd bump, 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 bump all the way there. And he'd never, by the time you got there, you had a definite belief in God, you know? And that old man taught me what the word commitment meant. That, you know, I've seen in just a short time I've been here, I've seen that word kind of erode a little bit. You see, when I got sober with the people I got sober with, and my sponsor, a commitment was like this. In a breakfast of bacon and eggs, who had the commitment, the pig or the chicken? The pig. He says the only reason for missing a commitment, there's only one excuse, and that's you died on the way there. He says, anything else is an excuse, and you've used all your excuses up a long time ago. He says, when you say you're going to do something as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be there, you're going to be on time, you're going to be dressed and ready to go. And that's what he raised me on. And he got me involved in the Hospital Institutional Committee. And for the next 10 years, I served in over 52 institutions. I became the director, the assistant director, the chairperson of the corrections, the liaison with the correctional facilities, and it was my life, and it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life. I met people in those institutions and jails that are dear to my heart today and very dear friends of mine, and I have godchildren of people who have been through prison that I've met after they've got out. You know, I sponsor guys that have been sober for over 12 years now. You know, and I met these guys after doing 25 years in these places, and I watched God and work in their life. I watched this miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happen in these people's lives by carrying the message in behind those walls and digging through all that bullshit and just being absolutely, totally honest about who I was and what I was and what I have to do. And things happened in my life that's absolutely impossible to happen. I have a seventh grade education. One of the most ridiculous things he told me to do is told me to get a job. He said, sober people work. And I went, I want to work in my sobriety. He says, yeah, right. He says, you go to work every day for 8 hours and you go to a meeting every night for 2 hours and go to coffee for 2 hours after that and then get some sleep. That's work. That's how you get sober. And I got my first check and I went to go pay. He said, they want all my money. And he looked at my check. He said, they don't want one penny of your money. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, they just want theirs. Oh. Okay. They didn't even get an ID in my real name. That was a shock. I met her at a meeting. God bless her. Wonderful, wonderful woman. Between me and her, we had 6 children and a desire to stop drinking, and that was about it. And we got married in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told her, I said, you'll never be more important than my sobriety. Nothing comes in front of me going to AA, and she got all pissed off. She goes, wow, how romantic. You know, and if you're going to do that, so am I. And she got involved in the Hospital Institutional Committee, and she was a chairperson for all the women facilities in San Diego and all. And we had a wonderful life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had one of the best marriages I've ever known of anyone having, but it was based upon Alcoholics Anonymous. It was based upon service to our family, to the fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous, to the people confined into our families. You know, and we built a real good life. I became a contractor. I made an awful lot of money. I made a lot of money, and things in my life were good. At 10 years sobriety, I had it all. I had the house on the hill. I had the boat. I had my children back, that little boy. I got to spend 10 years with him, and I watched him graduate from high school at the age of 22 because I got involved in his life, and we became real active in the Special Olympics and a lot of other programs for handicapped children. And that little girl I drug all around the country, she started going to college, and in 2 weeks I'm going to her graduation. And she's got her master's degree, and she made National Honor Roll Society cum laude, and working with our handicapped children, special education. But I watched her get married, and I watched all these wonderful things happen in her life, and my children, and these other children that I had adopted, these other three girls, and I had it going on. I was a member of a church. I was an assistant director of the hospital institutional committee. I'd made over $50,000 on one job, and I decided to take 2 months, and I wanted to see what Australia had to do with AA. So I went and spent two months over there just going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous all over Australia and had the greatest vacation a human being can possibly have. And I got back to California, and I was just looking at my life, how blessed it was, how truly blessed my life was. And I'm reading in the paper. At 3 years sober, I got a phone call, and a little girl asked me if I knew this other woman. And I said, yeah, a long time ago. She said, that's my mother. She goes, you're my father, and I've been looking for you for over 20 years. And I want you to meet your grandchildren. And that little girl that was born when I was in prison came into my life, and those grandbabies came into my life. And I had it all. I had all my dreams, everything. And I opened up that paper that day, and I read in the paper where a man had broken into this woman's house and raped her in front of her children and took a knife and cut this woman to pieces. And I was just shocked, and I got down to the name, and it was my daughter. A man had just gotten out of prison for doing exactly the same thing to another woman 2 weeks before. I'll tell you that I am absolutely perfectly capable of first-degree murder if you touch anything I care about. I went to that hospital to go see my daughter, and that man had taken a knife, and she'd lost her arm, she'd lost her breast, and most of her face. And I don't know a lot about... I hear guys talk about anger and rage and all this shit, excuse my language. I know about getting real, real quiet. I know about it getting real ice cold inside. And I know I start making plans for your future, and I'm not talking about it. And I ain't giving up nothing. I plan on getting away with it. And that's where I'm at. I'm right where I've been 100 times before in my life, and I'm not walking with God, and I am absolutely nuts, and I can't sleep. And I'm angry, and I can't talk about this. I can't say nothing. And I'm looking in that book for, I'm looking for an out, man. I'm looking for a loophole. Well, I know where this guy is. He's in an institution. They cops caught him. I know people there, and we all know how to work that, And I'm struggling with this issue so bad, and I'm reading that book, and I'm trying to find a way out of there, and it says that I cannot live in anger. I cannot live in resentment because it will cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity will return, I'll drink. My sponsor told me when I got here that the condition for me being sober would be this, that absolutely nothing, no woman, no child, no job, no nothing in this world could ever be more important than me doing the things that I have to do to maintain my sobriety. And the day that I think anything or anyone is more important than me doing those things and living by these principles, that's the day I'm going to take a drink, and I'll never get to get sober again. And the hardest thing I have ever done in this block called Alcoholics Anonymous was to get down on my knees and pray for that man to have everything out of life that I wanted. And maybe there's someone here that thinks I'm a punk. Okay, I'm a punk, but I'm a sober one, I didn't have to drink, and I'm not going to tell anyone here and lie to you and tell you I forgive this man. That's something I pray on every single day, and part of my prayer is our paths don't cross. But I can tell you the insanity went away. that ice water inside of me went away. And I was able to talk about it, and I was able to do what I needed to do, and I was able to take care of my daughter and my grandchildren and be there as a father and a grandfather for the first time when they needed me more than they had ever needed me in their life. And I was there for them, and I was sober. You know, I got through that, and I didn't have to drink. And right after that, they told me I had cancer, and they were going to have to cut my lips off. I like my lips, you know. Love them right where they're at. And they're telling me the surgery is going to be extremely painful. And I go to all these different doctors, and I find this plastic surgeon, and he tells me this radical surgery they're going to do on my lower mouth. And I'm going, man. And he goes, I said, you have to understand something. I can't put anything in my body that affects me from the neck up. He goes, it's impossible. You can't walk through this. This is going to hurt. He says, we're going to remove about half of your lip. And that's all nerves. And I said, you know what? I can do it. You can't put anything in me. I said, I'm walking through a lot of emotional pain, and I'm an addict. I'm an alcoholic. If you put anything in there to block any of that stuff, I'll never be able to stop again. And I talked this doctor in, and I had that surgery, and they cut my mouth from there to here, and then brought it all back together. And I'm going to tell you, I did that on aspirin and Novocaine. And I don't recommend that to anybody. You know, I ain't telling you I'm a tough guy. I'm telling you I am a sissy. I will do anything in this world if I don't have to get sober again. Anything in this world, no matter what I got to do to stay sober, it's easier to stay sober than to get sober again. You know, and I got through that. Something going on with my wife, and I had loved this woman. I adored this woman. This was the very first woman that I had really ever completely let myself be intimate with, to share who I was as a human being, to talk about my dreams, my fears, and all this stuff. I'd never trusted a woman that much. And I did that with her. And something was going on, and I didn't know what was going on with her. And we'd always been so close. And I said, I came home, I said, Karen, what's going on? And she looked at me, and she just said, sit down, we got to talk. And I sat down, and she looked at me. She said, Kip, she says, I love you, you know that. She goes, you're my dearest friend, you know. And you're the kind of man I always dreamed about. I love our life together. She goes, but I can't live this lie anymore. I said, what are you talking about? And she said, I'm a lesbian. And I'm in love with Chrissy, and I can't live this lie anymore. And I haven't been unfaithful to you, but I can't do this anymore. I have to leave. And I was not expecting that. I had no tools for that. So I react the way I always react when I'm scared. I reacted with anger. And I called her every name in the book, and I was an ugly human being. I didn't lay any hands on her, but I insulted her and called her every name in the book, and I walked away with rage and the same thing. I walked away, I moved in this motel, and I just lived on hate. Just nothing but pure hate. This woman had done me so. You know, another issue of that, where he just passed away, Father Bill Wilson, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years. He was my godfather in the church. So the Catholic priest, he's going to be on my side. So I'm going to go tell him about my sad woe, you know. And so we go in there and we have a meeting, and I'm telling him how this woman has wronged me. All these wonderful things I've done for her. What a good man I've been. Blah, 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 blah. And he's looking at me, and all of a sudden he busted out laughing. And I said, what? He said, you read that book a lot, don't you? And I said, yeah. He said, you sound exactly like that guy on page 61. I go, what one? You know that guy that thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he only managed well? Sometimes he was nice, sometimes he was kind, you know, but whatever he did, there was always a hook in it. He goes, you should tell me all this stuff you did for her, what a wonderful man you were, and how she has wronged you. First of all, I'm your confessor. I'm your confessor. You did your fifth step with me. You have no right to stand and judge anyone's sexuality. You know? Because you don't own that woman. That's her business. She's going through a rough time right now. I said, do you love her? And I went, what? He says, you don't know anything about love, do you? She says, I want you to go right. I go, wait a minute. You don't understand what I'm here, you know, for. Because I understand what you want me to condone how you're feeling, or how you're feeling is you're just feeling sorry for yourself. You're just trying to play God in another human being's life, and your God suit don't fit too well. And I said, well, what do you think? I said, I think you owe her an amends. I owe her an amends. Because you go write about it and call me. And I went and wrote about it. I went and wrote about that marriage and realized that that woman had been a good wife, had been a good friend, had honored her vows until she couldn't. And she was honest with me. And I realized I did love her. And the only place I ever learned anything about love was from you people. You didn't ask me about my sexuality. You didn't ask about anything. You asked me if I wanted to stop drinking. You told me you'd love me. And you have loved me. And I went back to that woman and I made amends and we got a divorce and she kept my last name and today she's my sister. And we're very, very, very dear friends. We share the same sobriety date. We still give cakes to each other every year. And we talk and we've been involved in panels in Alcoholics Anonymous and she's my friend. And I found out that I didn't have to throw away a relationship because it changed. But I could allow the relationship to change and I could still care for someone. You know, that God's in charge of all this, not me, thank God. You know, and you know, right after that, I got attacked by a dog and I almost lost my arm. I was in a hospital. I couldn't work no more. I ended up losing my business. I lost the house. I lost absolutely everything I'd worked for 10 years. And the only thing left was me and my son. And me and my little boy, he's that sick. He was 24 years old now. And I took him to the hospital and I spent the last 4 months in that hospital with him. And he died in my arms, you know, October 4th. And that's when I got to find out about serenity and I got to find out when all these horrible things would happen that all that work I had done, all that work I had done, all those meetings I had been to, all those different H&I conferences and everything else I had ever done, every little part I had given is where I got the tools to stay sober when my life happened and I was able to walk through it because I'd been talking about this stuff and doing it, and doing it, and doing it. And I knew how to do it because I learned how to do it here. And I didn't have to drink. You know, today in my life, I was single for a long time and I remarried 2 years ago. But 3 years ago, I got a phone call from a woman. I'd been living by myself. I wasn't going to have a relationship until I didn't need one. You know, but I dated, messed around a little bit, as some of us do once in a while. Well, not all of us, but some of us. And I got this phone call on it. I said, what? And it was this girl's mother. And I said, well, how you doing? She goes, well, she got drunk. She got in a car wreck and she's all messed up, got massive brain damage. And, oh, God, I'm sorry. What can I do? She goes, well, you can come and pick up your daughter. And I went, what are you talking about? She goes, you have a 3-month-old daughter. I'm not taking care of it. I didn't, you know, I drove up there and she put this little baby in my arms and it looked exactly like me. And I went, wow. And I fell head over heels in love. And it was just me and her for a year. You know? I remarried and 18 months ago my wife had another son of my own, William Casey. The thing about this is, you know, that I've got to walk through my life and experience everything there was to experience, the good stuff, the bad stuff, the painful stuff, the joyful stuff, and I haven't had to amplify and I haven't had to hide from any of it. The worst periods of my sobriety have been my greatest growth. And that's when you find out if these steps work. This is when you find out it works, man, in those midnights. And I've had a lot of them. I'll probably have some more. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will work for anybody, anywhere, under any circumstances. You know, I'm kind of going way long-winded here, and I tend to do that once I get started. I apologize, but I'm all done. You guys can go smoke now. Thanks for having me.